Chapter 15. The Saudi Arabian Money Laundering Affair. In 1974, a diplomat from Saudi Arabia showed me photos of Riyadh, the capital of his country. Included in these photos was a herd of goats rummaging among piles of refuse outside a government building. When I asked the diplomat about them, his response shocked me. He told me that they were the city's main garbage disposal system. "No self-respecting Saudi would ever collect trash," he said. "We leave it to the beasts." Goats in the capital of the world's greatest oil kingdom. It seemed unbelievable. At the time, I was one of a group of consultants just beginning to try to piece together a solution to the oil crisis. Those goats led me to an understanding of how that solution might evolve, especially given the country's pattern of development over the previous three centuries. Saudi Arabia's history is full of violence and religious fanaticism. In the 18th century, Muhammad ibn Saud, a local warlord, joined forces with fundamentalists from the ultra-conservative Wahhabi sect. It was a powerful union, and during the next 200 years, the Saud family and their Wahhabi allies conquered most of the Arabian Peninsula, including Islam's holiest sites, Mecca and Medina. Saudi society reflected the puritanical idealism of its founders, and a strict interpretation of Quranic beliefs was enforced. Religious police ensured adherence to the mandate to pray five times a day. Women were required to cover themselves from head to toe. Punishment for criminals was severe. Public executions and stonings were common. During my first visit to Riyadh, I was amazed when my driver told me I could leave my camera, briefcase, and even my wallet in plain sight inside our car, parked near the open market, without locking it. "No one," he said, "would think of stealing here. Thieves have their hands cut off." Later that day, he asked me if I would like to visit so-called Chop Chop Square and watch a beheading. Wahhabism's adherence to what we would consider extreme Puritanism made the streets safe from thieves and demanded the harshest form of corporal punishment for those who violated the laws. I declined the invitation. The Saudi view of religion as an important element of politics and economics contributed to the oil embargo that shook the Western world. On October 6, 1973, Yom Kippur, the holiest of Jewish holidays, Egypt and Syria launched simultaneous attacks on Israel. It was the beginning of the October War, the fourth and most destructive of the Arab-Israeli wars, and the one that would have the greatest impact on the world. Egypt's President Sadat pressured Saudi Arabia's King Faisal to retaliate against the United States' complicity with Israel by employing what Sadat referred to as the oil weapon. On October 16th, Iran and the five Arab Gulf states, including Saudi Arabia, announced a 70% increase in the posted price of oil. Meeting in Kuwait City, Arab oil ministers pondered further options. The Iraqi representative was vehemently in favor of targeting the United States. He called on the other delegates to nationalize American businesses in the Arab world, to impose a total oil embargo on the United States and on all other nations friendly to Israel, and to withdraw Arab funds from every American bank. He pointed out that Arab bank accounts were substantial, and that this action could result in a panic not unlike that of 1929. Other Arab ministers were reluctant to agree to such a radical plan, but on October 17th, they did decide to move forward with a more limited embargo, which would begin with a 5% cut in production and then impose an additional 5% reduction every month until their political objectives were met. They agreed that the United States should be punished for its pro-Israeli stance and should therefore have the most severe embargo levied against it. Several of the countries attending the meeting announced that they would implement cutbacks of 10% rather than 5%. On October 19th, President Nixon asked Congress for $2.2 billion in aid to Israel. The next day, Saudi Arabia and other Arab producers imposed a total embargo on oil shipments to the United States. The oil embargo ended on March 18, 1974. Its duration was short, its impact immense. The selling price of Saudi oil leaped from $1.39 a barrel on January 1, 1970, to $8.32 on January 1, 1974. Politicians and future administrations would never forget the lessons learned during the early to mid-1970s. In the long run, the trauma of those few months served to strengthen the corporatocracy. Its three pillars, big corporations, international banks, and government, bonded as never before. That bond would endure. The embargo also resulted in significant attitude and policy changes. It convinced Wall Street and Washington that such an embargo could never again be tolerated. Protecting our oil supplies had always been a priority. After 1973, it became an obsession. The embargo elevated Saudi Arabia's status as a player in world politics and forced Washington to recognize the kingdom's strategic importance to our own economy. Furthermore, it encouraged U.S. corporatocracy leaders to search desperately for methods to funnel petrodollars back to America and to ponder the fact that the Saudi government lacked the administrative and institutional frameworks to properly manage its mushrooming wealth. For Saudi Arabia, the additional oil income resulting from the price hikes was a mixed blessing. It filled the national coffers with billions of dollars. However, it also served to undermine some of the strict religious beliefs of the Wahhabis. Wealthy Saudis traveled around the world. They attended schools and universities in Europe and the United States. They bought fancy cars and furnished their houses with Western-style goods. Conservative religious beliefs were replaced by a new form of materialism, and it was this materialism that presented a solution to fears of future oil crises. Almost immediately after the embargo ended, Washington began negotiating with the Saudis, offering them technical support, military hardware and training, and an opportunity to bring their nation into the 20th century in exchange for petrodollars and, most importantly, assurances that there would never again be another oil embargo. The negotiations resulted in the creation of a most extraordinary organization, the United States-Saudi Arabian Joint Economic Commission. Known as JCOR, it embodied an innovative concept that was the opposite of traditional foreign aid programs. It relied on Saudi money to hire American firms to build up Saudi Arabia. Although overall management and fiscal responsibility were delegated to the U.S. Department of the Treasury, this commission was independent to the extreme. Ultimately, it would spend billions of dollars over a period of more than 25 years, with virtually no congressional oversight. Because no U.S. funding was involved, Congress had no authority in the matter, despite Treasury's role. After studying JCOR extensively, David Holden and Richard Johns conclude, "It was the most far-reaching agreement of its kind ever concluded by the U.S. with a developing country. It had the potential to entrench the U.S. deeply in the kingdom, fortifying the concept of mutual interdependence." The Department of the Treasury brought Maine in at an early stage to serve as an advisor. I was summoned and told that my job would be critical and that everything I did and learned should be considered highly confidential. From my vantage point, it seemed like a clandestine operation. At the time, I was led to believe that Maine was the lead consultant in that process. I subsequently came to realize that we were one of several consultants whose expertise was sought. Since everything was done in the greatest secrecy, I was not privy to Treasury's discussions with other consultants, and I therefore cannot be certain about the importance of my role in this precedent-setting deal. I do know that the arrangement established new standards for EHMs, and that it launched innovative alternatives to the traditional approaches for advancing the interests of empire. I also know that most of the scenarios that evolved from my studies were ultimately implemented. that Maine was rewarded with one of the first major and extremely profitable contracts in Saudi Arabia, and that I received a large bonus that year. My job was to develop forecasts of what might happen in Saudi Arabia if vast amounts of money were invested in its infrastructure, and to map out scenarios for spending that money. In short, I was asked to apply as much creativity as I could to justifying the infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars into the Saudi Arabian economy, under conditions that would include U.S. engineering and construction companies. I was told to do this on my own, not to rely on my staff, and I was sequestered in a small conference room several floors above the one where my department was located. I was warned that my job was both a matter of national security and potentially very lucrative for Maine. I understood, of course, that the primary objective here was not the usual, to burden this country with debts it could never repay, but rather to find ways that would assure that a large portion of petrodollars found their way back to the United States. In the process, Saudi Arabia would be drawn in, its economy would become increasingly intertwined with and dependent upon ours, and presumably it would grow more westernized, and therefore more sympathetic with and integrated into our system. Once I got started, I realized that the goats wandering the streets of Riyadh were the symbolic key. They were a sore point among Saudis jet-setting around the world. Those goats begged to be replaced by something more appropriate for this desert kingdom that craved entry into the modern world. I also knew that OPEC economists were stressing the need for oil-rich countries to obtain more value-added products from their petroleum. Rather than simply exporting crude oil, the economists were urging these countries to develop industries of their own, to use this oil to produce petroleum-based products they could sell to the rest of the world at a higher price than that brought by the crude itself. This twin realization opened the door to a strategy I felt certain would be a win-win situation for everyone. The goats, of course, were merely an entry point. Oil revenues could be employed to hire U.S. companies to replace the goats with the world's most modern garbage collection and disposal system, and the Saudis could take great pride in this state-of-the-art technology. I came to think of the goats as one side of an equation that could be applied to most of the kingdom's economic sectors, a formula for success in the eyes of the royal family, the U.S. Department of the Treasury, and my bosses at Maine. Under this formula, money would be earmarked to create an industrial sector focused on transforming raw petroleum into finished products for export. Large petrochemical complexes would rise from the desert, and around them, huge industrial parks. Naturally, such a plan would also require the construction of thousands of megawatts of electrical generating capacity, transmission and distribution lines, highways, pipelines, communications networks, and transportation systems, including new airports, improved seaports, a vast array of service industries, and the infrastructure essential to keep all these cogs turning. We all had high expectations that this plan would evolve into a model of how things should be done in the rest of the world. Globe-trotting Saudis would sing our praises. They would invite leaders from many countries to come to Saudi Arabia and witness the miracles we had accomplished. Those leaders would then call on us to help them devise similar plans for their countries and, in most cases, for countries outside the ring of OPEC, would arrange World Bank or other debt-ridden methods for financing them. The global empire would be well served. As I worked through these ideas, I thought of the goats, and the words of my driver often echoed in my ears. No self-respecting Saudi would ever collect trash. I had heard that refrain repeatedly, in many different contexts. It was obvious that the Saudis had no intention of putting their own people to work at menial tasks, whether as laborers in industrial facilities or in the actual construction of any of the projects. In the first place, there were too few of them. In addition, the Royal House of Saud had indicated a commitment to providing its citizens with a level of education and a lifestyle that were inconsistent with those of manual laborers. The Saudis might manage others, but they had no desire or motivation to become factory and construction workers. Therefore, it would be necessary to import a labor force from other countries, countries where labor was cheap and where people needed work. If possible, the labor should come from other Middle Eastern or Islamic countries, such as Egypt, Palestine, Pakistan, and Yemen. This prospect created an even greater new stratagem for development opportunities. Mammoth housing complexes would have to be constructed for these laborers, as would shopping malls, hospitals, fire and police department facilities, water and sewage treatment plants, electrical, communications, and transportation networks. In fact, the end result would be to create modern cities where once only deserts had existed. Here, too, was the opportunity to explore emerging technologies in, for example, desalinization plants, microwave systems, healthcare complexes, and computer technologies. Saudi Arabia was a planner's dream come true, and also a fantasy realized for anyone associated with the engineering and construction business. It presented an economic opportunity unrivaled by any other in history, an underdeveloped country with virtually unlimited financial resources and a desire to enter the modern age in a big way, very quickly. I must admit that I enjoyed this job immensely. There was no solid data available in Saudi Arabia, in the Boston Public Library, or anywhere else that justified the use of econometric models in this context. In fact, the magnitude of the job, the total and immediate transformation of an entire nation on a scale never before witnessed, meant that even had historical data existed, it would have been irrelevant. Nor was anyone expecting this type of quantitative analysis, at least not at this stage of the game. I simply put my imagination to work and wrote reports that envisioned a glorious future for the kingdom. I had rule-of-thumb numbers I could use to estimate such things as the approximate cost to produce a megawatt of electricity, a mile of road, or adequate water, sewage, housing, food, and public services for one laborer. I was not supposed to refine these estimates or to draw final conclusions. My job was simply to describe a series of plans, more accurately perhaps visions, of what might be possible, and to arrive at rough estimates of the costs associated with them. I always kept in mind the true objectives, maximizing payouts to U.S. firms and making Saudi Arabia increasingly dependent on the United States. It did not take long to realize how closely the two went together. Almost all the newly developed projects would require continual upgrading and servicing, and they were so highly technical as to assure that the companies that originally developed them would have to maintain and modernize them. In fact, as I moved forward with my work, I began to assemble two lists for each of the projects I envisioned, one for the types of design and construction contracts we could expect, and another for long-term service and management agreements. Maine, Bechtel, Brown & Root, Halliburton, Stone & Webster, and many other U.S. engineers and contractors would profit handsomely for decades to come. Beyond the purely economic, there was another twist that would render Saudi Arabia dependent on us, though in a very different way. The modernization of this oil-rich kingdom would trigger adverse reactions. For instance, conservative Muslims would be furious. Israel and other neighboring countries would feel threatened. The economic development of this nation was likely to spawn the growth of another industry, protecting the Arabian Peninsula. Private companies specializing in such activities, as well as the U.S. military and defense industry, could expect generous contracts and, once again, long-term service and management agreements. Their presence would require another phase of engineering and construction projects, including airports, missile sites, personnel bases, and all of the infrastructure associated with such facilities. I sent my reports in sealed envelopes through interoffice mail addressed to Treasury Department Project Manager. I occasionally met with a couple of other members of our team, vice presidents at Maine, and my superiors. Since we had no official name for this project, which was still in the research and development phase and was not yet part of J-Corps, we referred to it only, and with hushed voices, as SAMA. Ostensibly, this stood for Saudi Arabian Money Laundering Affair, but it was also a tongue-in-cheek play on words. The kingdom's central bank was called the Saudi Arabian Monetary Agency, or SAMA. Sometimes a Treasury representative would join us. I asked few questions during these meetings. Mainly, I just described my work, responded to their comments, and agreed to try to do whatever was asked of me. The vice presidents and Treasury representatives were especially impressed with my ideas about the long-term service and management agreements. It prodded one of the vice presidents to coin a phrase we often used after that, referring to the kingdom as the cow we can milk until the sun sets on our retirement. For me, that phrase always conjured images of goats rather than cows. It was during those meetings that I came to realize that several of our competitors were involved in similar tasks, and that in the end, we all expected to be awarded lucrative contracts as a result of our efforts. I assumed that Maine and the other firms were footing the bill for this preliminary work, taking a short-term risk in order to throw our hats into the ring. This assumption was reinforced by the fact that the number I charged my time to on our daily personal timesheets appeared to be a general and administrative overhead account. Such an approach was typical of the research and development proposal preparation phase of most projects. In this case, the initial investment certainly far exceeded the norm, but those vice presidents seemed extremely confident about the payback. Despite the knowledge that our competitors were also involved, we all assumed that there was enough work to go around. I also had been in the business long enough to believe that the rewards bestowed would reflect the level of Treasury's acceptance of the work we had done, and that those consultants who came up with the approaches that were finally implemented would receive the choicest contracts. I took it as a personal challenge to create scenarios that would make it to the design and construct stage. My star was already rising rapidly at Maine. Being a key player in SAMA would guarantee its acceleration if we were successful. During our meetings, we also openly discussed the likelihood that SAMA and the entire J-Corps operation would set new precedents. It represented an innovative approach to creating lucrative work in countries that did not need to incur debts through the international banks. Iran and Iraq came immediately to mind as two additional examples of such countries. Moreover, given human nature, we felt that the leaders of such countries would likely be motivated to try to emulate Saudi Arabia. There seemed little doubt that the 1973 oil embargo, which had initially appeared to be so negative, would end up offering many unexpected gifts to the engineering and construction business, and would help to further pave the road to global empire. I worked on that visionary phase for about 8 months, although never for more than several intense days at a time, sequestered in my private conference room or in my apartment overlooking Boston Common. My staff all had other assignments and pretty much took care of themselves, although I checked in on them periodically. Over time, the secrecy around our work declined. More people became aware that something big involving Saudi Arabia was going on. Excitement swelled, rumors swirled. The vice presidents and treasury representatives grew more open, in part, I believe, because they themselves became privy to more information as details about the ingenious scheme emerged. Under this evolving plan, Washington wanted the Saudis to guarantee to maintain oil supplies and prices at levels that could fluctuate, but that would always remain acceptable to the United States and our allies. If other countries, such as Iran, Iraq, Indonesia, or Venezuela, threatened embargoes, Saudi Arabia, with its vast petroleum supplies, would step in to fill the gap. Simply the knowledge that they might do so would, in the long run, discourage other countries from even considering an embargo. In exchange for this guarantee, Washington would offer the House of Saud an amazingly attractive deal, a commitment to provide total and unequivocal U.S. political and, if necessary, military support, thereby ensuring their continued existence as rulers of their country. It was a deal the House of Saud could hardly refuse, given its geographic location, lack of military might, and general vulnerability to neighbors like Iran, Syria, Iraq, and Israel. Naturally, therefore, Washington used its advantage to impose one other critical condition, a condition that redefined the role of EHMs in the world, and served as a model we would later attempt to apply in other countries, most notably in Iraq. In retrospect, I sometimes find it difficult to understand how Saudi Arabia could have accepted this condition. Certainly, most of the rest of the Arab world, OPEC and other Islamic countries, were appalled when they discovered the terms of the deal and the manner in which the royal house capitulated to Washington's demands. The condition was that Saudi Arabia would use its petrodollars to purchase U.S. government securities. In turn, the interest earned by these securities would be spent by the U.S. Department of the Treasury in ways that enabled Saudi Arabia to emerge from a medieval society into the modern industrialized world. In other words, the interest, compounding on billions of dollars of the kingdom's oil income, would be used to pay U.S. companies to fulfill the vision I, and presumably some of my competitors, had come up with to convert Saudi Arabia into a modern industrial power. Our own U.S. Department of the Treasury would hire us at Saudi expense to build infrastructure projects and even entire cities throughout the Arabian Peninsula. Although the Saudis reserved the rights to provide input regarding the general nature of these projects, the reality was that an elite core of foreigners, mostly infidels in the eyes of Muslims, would determine the future appearance and economic makeup of the Arabian Peninsula, and this would occur in a kingdom founded on conservative Wahhabi principles and run according to those principles for several centuries. It seemed a huge leap of faith on their part, yet, under the circumstances, and due to the political and military pressures undoubtedly brought to bear by Washington, I suspected the Saud family felt they had few alternatives. From our perspective, the prospects for immense profits seemed limitless. It was a sweetheart deal with potential to set an amazing precedent. And to make the deal even sweeter, no one had to obtain congressional approval, a process loathed by corporations, particularly privately owned ones like Bechtel and Maine, which prefer not to open their books or share their secrets with anyone. Thomas W. Lipman, an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute and a former journalist, eloquently summarizes the salient points of this deal. The Saudis, rolling in cash, would deliver hundreds of millions of dollars to Treasury, which held on to the funds until they were needed to pay vendors or employees. This system assured that the Saudi money would be recycled back into the American economy. It also ensured that the commission's managers could undertake whatever projects they and the Saudis agreed were useful, without having to justify them to Congress. Establishing the parameters for this historic undertaking took less time than anyone could have imagined. After that, however, we had to figure out a way to implement it. To set the process in motion, someone at the highest level of government was dispatched to Saudi Arabia, an extremely confidential mission. I never knew for sure, but I believe the envoy was Henry Kissinger. Whoever the envoy was, his first job was to remind the royal family about what had happened in neighboring Iran when Mossadegh tried to oust British petroleum interests. Next, he would outline a plan that would be too attractive for them to turn down, in effect conveying to the Saudis that they had few alternatives. I have no doubt that they were left with a distinct impression that they could either accept our offer and thus gain assurances that we would support and protect them as rulers, or they could refuse and go the way of Mossadegh. When the envoy returned to Washington, he brought with him the message that the Saudis would like to comply. There was just one slight obstacle. We would have to convince key players in the Saudi government. This, we were informed, was a family matter. Saudi Arabia was not a democracy, and yet it seemed that within the House of Saud there was a need for consensus. In 1975, I was assigned to one of those key players. I always thought of him as Prince W, although I never determined that he was actually a crown prince. My job was to persuade him that the Saudi Arabia money laundering affair would benefit his country as well as him personally. This was not as easy as it appeared at first. Prince W professed himself a good Wahhabi, and insisted that he did not want to see his country follow in the footsteps of Western commercialism. He also claimed that he understood the insidious nature of what we were proposing. We had, he said, the same objectives as the Crusaders a millennium earlier, the Christianization of the Arab world. In fact, he was partially right about this. In my opinion, the difference between the Crusaders and us was a matter of degree. Europe's medieval Catholics claimed their goal was to save Muslims from purgatory. We claimed that we wanted to help the Saudis modernize. In truth, I believe the Crusaders, like the corporatocracy, were primarily seeking to expand their empire. Religious beliefs aside, Prince W had one weakness, for beautiful blondes. It seems almost ludicrous to mention what has now become an unfair stereotype. And I should mention that Prince W was the only man among many Saudis I have known who had this proclivity, or at least the only one who was willing to let me see it. Yet it played a role in structuring this historic deal, and it demonstrates how far I would go to complete my mission.